Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Delighted to have Dr. Sally Temple with us. Sally Temple was raised in York, England. She received a BA in developmental neuroscience from Cambridge University, UK, and a PhD working with Martin Raff at University College London on optic nerve development. She attended Columbia University in the New York City, of course, to study spinal cord development with Tom Jessel before moving to Miami University, where her husband was attending medical school. In Miami, Sally discovered that the embryonic mammalian brain contained a rare stem cell, a study published in Nature in 1989, which contributed fundamentally to our understanding that the central nervous system has regenerative potential. Since then, she has continued to make pioneering contributions to the field of stem cell research, focused on the question of how neural stem cells alter their developmental potential over time to generate diverse progeny and how they can be harnessed for nervous system repair. Sally became a professor at Albany Medical College in the Center for Neuroscience and Neuropharmacology in 2003 and was awarded the prestigious Jacob Javits Merit Award from NIH, National Institutes of Health, in 2003. In August 2007, she co-founded with her husband, Dr. Jeffrey Stern, an independent nonprofit research institute, the NeuroCell Institute, and the Regenerative Research Foundation in Rensselaer, New York, with the mission of using neurostem cells to develop therapeutics for eye, brain, and spinal cord disorders. As scientific director of NSCI, she oversees the research mission from basic to translational projects and is responsible for the staff, budget, and developing the strategic plan for the institute. Sally is a member of the board of directors of the International Society for Stem Cell Research and of the medical advisory boards of the New York Stem Cell Foundation and the Genetics Policy Institute in 2008, Dr. Temple was awarded a MacArthur Fellowship in recognition of her contributions to neural stem biology. In 2003, she and Dr. Stern were awarded a $10.8 million New York Stem Consortium grant to bring a novel retinal pigment epithelial stem cell towards a clinical trial for age-related macular degeneration in 4 years. This exciting project exemplifies the mission of NSCI to bring stem cell therapies from the bench to the bedside. Welcome, Sally Temple.
Thank you.
I'm glad you're here. You come very well recommended by everybody. Yeah. So what was it when you were awarded a MacArthur Fellowship? How did that feel?
Well, first of all, it was a total surprise.
Was it?
They call you, and I happened to be home at the time. They call you up without any idea, you know, not telling you at all that you have won this award. Mm-hmm. And then gradually, through the phone call, you learn that you've received this award. And so it was a wonderful, wonderful surprise.
So wait a second. Do I understand you correctly that they were sort of just talking to you, and then all of a sudden, and by the way, you've won the MacArthur Award?
Yes. So unbeknownst to me, there were 15 people in a room making the phone call. And I could hear one person saying, you know, a little bit about the research, and then have you heard about this foundation? And then they told us. And of course, I think everybody enjoyed knowing that they were hearing the surprise and delight firsthand.
Well, everybody that I know who knows you says you're a genius.
You haven't talked to my children.
How old are your kids?
24, 21, and 18.
Looking at you, just so everybody out there knows it, that seems impossible.
Oh,
but anyway, how did your interest in this begin?
So I was really driven by...
You were in England at the time.
Yes. I was in England, and from starting my career in science research, I was fascinated by development, how things formed. And it seemed to me that the greatest challenge was to try to understand how the brain formed, because that was the most complex organ. So from the beginning, I began to look at how the cells that made the brain, how they were regulated, how they divided, how they made their progeny, and basically how they interacted to produce this exquisite structure.
So just so a few of us who are listening to this get familiar with the terms, progeny always seemed to me to mean their children.
The
children of cells. Okay. And that became, you know, important to you. Was this sort of cutting edge when you were doing it?
It was, because at that time we knew relatively little about the developing system. Knowledge was building about the mature brain and how it functions, but our understanding of how we get there from the embryo right through to adulthood, that was really just beginning to emerge. And at that time, we had so few tools available to ask the questions. We didn't have the sophisticated imaging, microscopes, molecular tools that we have now.
So it was more theoretical than evidence-based at the time.
It was definitely both, but I would say that the experimental science was held back because we didn't have the tools that we have available today. Now we're in a completely different position, and the research is accelerating at an enormous pace.
So, Sally Temple, or Dr. Sally Temple, let me ask you this. How political is your research?
Oh, so, you know, the research was thrust into the political arena. And this was somewhat of a surprise, although perhaps in retrospect not. What happened was, while we were working away on model systems, and a colleague and actual lecturer of mine at Cambridge University.
You mean your professor, as we say around here.
Professor, yeah, at Cambridge University, had made a really important discovery, which was that you could take a mouse embryo at the very early stage, when it's just a little ball of maybe 100 cells, and from that extract an what they call the inner cell mass. It's like the kernel of that structure. And put it in culture and create a cell line that could make any tissue of the body. So this was from mouse, and this was back in around 1981. And the research was also done in this country by someone called Gail Martin. These were incredibly exciting research findings. But then in about 15, 16 years later, the discovery was made that you could do the same thing with the human embryo.
Was there any question from the very beginning that if you could do it from a mouse, you could also do it for
you? You know, probably. But the hurdles with working with human embryos are very distinct. So at that time, that caused, I think, everybody to pause. And I think that was actually a good thing. Because when you have something that is so revolutionary and so powerful, you do want to consider what the implications are. And at that time then, George Bush was president, and he put restrictions on the ability to fund research that was aimed at creating these very special lines, which are called human embryonic stem cell lines. And everybody in the stem cell field, even those of us working in model systems, were affected by this. In a way, it catapulted the field forward. Sometimes when you have some perhaps negative ideas out there that are gaining prominence, at the same time, the people who are for this and recognize the value and the importance for human health and healing, they also came forward and created a very strong discussion. And the field actually attracted a lot of interest and continues to do so.
So let me get this straight. If George Bush tells the people in the United States you can only do so many lines or whatever you have to do, isn't it clear that the Israelis or somebody else will do it?
A lot of the lines that we work on today did come from Israel and also from Australia. And now, of course, we are able to generate these lines in the private sector. So that work continues.
So all he wasn't making it a law you couldn't do it. He was just saying we're not going to finance it,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So it did continue. And we now do have a lot of human embryonic stem cell lines that we can work on. But a new technology was developed recently that, to some extent, well, it certainly supplements the work with the human embryonic stem cells. And I think it's made the issue a little bit less controversial.
And what is that?
So this was an incredible discovery that was made by Shinya Yamanaka from Japan. And what he found was that you could take even a skin cell from a human being and put in just four genes, and those cells would revert back into that human embryonic stem cell state. So it was a cell that was induced to become similar to the human ES cells, as we call them, the embryonic stem cells that are very controversial. But the origin of this cell was a simple skin cell.
Yeah, it was not from a baby or...
It was not from a blastocyst, an early embryo. Yes, yeah. No one takes these cells from babies. They take them from the blastocyst.
Can we go over that one more time?
Yeah, sure.
Sally, you were wonderful, and I appreciate it so much, but we all want to keep up. So tell us what he did again.
So what he did was he showed that you could take a skin cell from an adult mouse or an adult person.
Yes.
And put into that cell four genes that would then revert the cell back to a human embryonic stem cell state.
So what four genes?
So the genes are OCT4, KLF4, SOX2, and c-MYC.
Okay.
Yeah. And then a different group in the States, led by Jamie Thompson, found a different four genes can also work. But the point being that these cells, which are called induced pluripotent stem cells, now allow us to do the sorts of projects that we're doing with the human embryonic cells with a cell that is much less controversial. And a lot of people now, globally, it didn't put an end to it, because I think people still recognize that the human embryonic stem cells have a place. They're almost a gold standard from which you're comparing these other lines. But it did mean that there certainly we had now new opportunities.
Okay, so as the government, who under Bush said, okay, limited, is the government now putting more money into this?
Oh, yes. Yes. To date, you can work on human-induced pluripotent stem cells, you know, provided you compete successfully for the grant, there's no restriction. You do have to be careful about making sure you get the correct consents to generate the lines and so forth.
Sure.
But yes, that is the case. And I just want to point out that Shinya Yamanaka got the Albany Prize a couple of years ago.
Oh, interesting. That Albany has a top medical prize.
Right. Yes.
This is, I think, one of the top medical prizes in the world, right?
It is.
Yes.
It is.
Yeah.
And the neat thing is that just a short time after that, he got the Nobel Prize.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So that was last fall.
Yeah. Okay, so to what end, Sally? I guess that's the question I want to know. You're working on something that has to do with macular degeneration, right?
Mm-hmm.
So explain that to us.
So we've been talking about what people call pluripotent stem cells, meaning that they can generate any cell type in the body. But there are many different types of stem cells. When you scratch yourself and the skin heals over, that's because you have stem cells in the skin that do that job. Or if you run out of red blood cells, the bone marrow, stem cells in your bone marrow then generate more red blood cells. So you have stem cells that are working to maintain and repair tissues all the time. And stem cell research is not just limited to human embryonic or to the iPS cells, but there's also this other class, which I call tissue-specific stem cells. Some people call adult stem cells, but I think the term tissue-specific is better. They also have a role. And what we have done is we've discovered in the adult human eye a new stem cell type, and it's a stem cell that resides in a special layer of the retina called the retinal pigment epithelium. So this layer is a simple, flat layer of cells at the back of the eye. Actually, when you look in a pupil and you see black, it's because you're seeing that black pigmented layer in the eye. And those cells are very, very important for the health of the retina. They are required for the photoreceptors, the cells that detect light, to work properly. So if that pigmented layer begins to degenerate, then the photoreceptors begin to degenerate, and then you lose vision. So this is actually what happens in a disease called age-related macular degeneration. Mm-hmm. And this is an enormous disease. It affects 1 in 5 people.
A lot of people.
Over age 75.
And how did you come to this particular... I mean, you could have chosen to cure Parkinson's disease or this or that. What made you do macular degeneration?
That's a great question. And being married to a retina researcher and a retina surgeon had nothing to do with it. No, I mean, it had a lot to do with it. But actually, it really was a logical choice. if you want to work on the central nervous system, which is the tissue that, that we know and love, to repair that tissue requires a very invasive therapy. I mean, you imagine that you would have to implant cells into the brain or into the spinal cord. Very difficult, deep surgeries. And then when you put the stem cells in there, you know, how do you track them? How do you make sure they're safe? So if you think about the central nervous system, the most accessible part is actually the retina. Mm-hmm. In that part of the central nervous system, you can inject relatively easily. And then the beauty of it is it comes conveniently with its own lens so that you can actually look in, you can see what you've done, see where the cells have gone, how they're integrating. And then there are very sensitive tests for vision. So in a way, it makes it an ideal first target for the central nervous system in general.
First target. Because
really?
It's a great beginning, but we'll get to the Parkinson's disease next.
I mean, for our point of view, yes. I mean, there are people still moving ahead
with
stem cell therapies for Parkinson's disease, including our friend and colleague, Lorenz Studer, who's down at Memorial Sloan Kettering, who's developing a therapy for that. But for us, first of all, there is a great unmet medical need for this disease.
Absolutely.
There's really nothing out there for people with
the dry
form. Have
you cured anybody yet?
So first of all, before you get to that stage, you have to do a clinical trial.
Okay.
And before you can enter a clinical trial, you have to present the FDA with a lot of evidence that what you're doing has a proof of concept and also that it should be safe. So we're on the way there.
But are you? Is this good or bad that we have to go to such? Because there are people sitting there with macular degeneration right now saying, cut it out, FDA. You know, we want this and we want it now.
You know, I heard a lot about interactions with the FDA and how difficult it is. And I've got to say that in our little experience so far, they have been incredibly encouraging. They clearly want to partner and work with us. And actually, we've benefited a great deal from these informal discussions that we've had to date. So, you know, we're excited to move ahead. And what the FDA has expressed to us, at least the people that we've spoken with, expressed an opinion that they are very excited about the application of stem cells and how they can be safely brought forward as therapies. And they are as eager as we are to see this progress.
To make it happen.
Yeah.
So, Sally Temple, the idea is that we've all been waiting for this for a long time. I'm 72, and I want you to hurry up. It's a joke, but
I'm more like a woman with light eyes, light skin. High on the probability list. My mom has this disease.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
Did that have anything to do with chick?
It definitely did.
It did.
It did. You know, I saw how she struggled, and it was awful to see someone whose you know favorite hobby is reading. To not be able to do that anymore.
Sure. So the idea is we're all waiting with bated breath to the point at which you go to the doctor, you say, I have Parkinson's disease or I have macular degeneration. They say, here, calls the nurse in and gets a shot and you're safe. That's the next great thing. I mean, breast cancer, for example, which we know the gene, we don't know the therapy, for it yet. Is that what we can all hope for in the next how many years?
So I think that we do have to realize how long it takes to do biomedical research. I mean, that's just a reality. It takes 10 years and it takes a lot of money to get a drug to the clinic. And that doesn't mean we shouldn't begin. And that doesn't mean we shouldn't have an active pipeline. We should. So I think that while we can see that end goal, we have to know the reality is it's 10 years away. Now, there are things that we've already done several years work on. And so they are coming along sooner. And we hope that the stem cell that we're working with, the retinal pigment epithelium, our plan is that we will have an application to the FDA in about 3.5 years from now. And that's a pace that we think is certainly achievable.
Really?
Yeah. And we are very, fortunate that New York State, their stem cell program, NiSTEM, as it's called, has recognized and the project and funded the project.
Now, there's a governor here who obviously believes in stem cell research. Mm-hmm. You set up, that's a good thing, I suppose, for you guys. You left Albany Med, you and your husband were there, and you set up a separate institute. Why'd you do that?
We did that because it requires a lot of focus and a lot of effort to push therapies through, to move from the bench, the research bench, to the bedside. And it really requires a singular focus. And what we realized was that if we were in the driver's seat, as it were, if we created a nonprofit and the sort of structure that's required to move a finding through that pipeline efficiently, that we would then have a much better chance of achieving the end goal. And so our decision to start the Neural Stem Cell Institute, which is the research arm of the Regenerative Research Foundation, our decision to do that was really to accelerate the therapies derived from stem cells.
Sally, how important is money in all of this?
Well, it's crucially important because it costs $10 million to get to a phase one trial. I mean, people don't realize this.
Sure.
And it costs, you know, tens of millions more to get to a phase two trial. And so it really, really is key. And I think that New York State, in recognizing the need to fund this translational research, it's visionary, and we're very grateful for it, because otherwise we would have this fantastic idea, but you need the wherewithal to push it forward.
So explain the bureaucracy that you've established here. You have an institute. You have a for-profit that is behind that, that you intend to use to raise some of that money you're talking about. Mm-hmm. So explain the way that it's looking.
So our primary focus is the 501c3 nonprofit institute, the Regenerative Research Foundation. And that structure allows us to apply for and compete for grants from New York State and the federal government. And well, we've been fortunate, even in a difficult funding climate, to get several grants so that we know that we have a few years of funding ahead of us, which is, you know, nice to be able to say that in the current climate. And at the same time, we realize that it is getting harder and harder to get grants. You know, at the NIH now, the funding level may be 10%. That means 90% of the time you apply for a grant, you fail, you get a rejection. And sometimes it's 93%. So how do you really protect yourself? And how do I protect the wonderful people who work for me?
How many people do work for you?
There are around 35 right now.
Okay.
And how do I ensure that they have jobs going forward?
Sure.
You know, this is something that we want to be successful in, not the therapeutic development, but also in the realm of economic development, in a way that here we have a center that is cutting edge in the nation, and we're able to provide high-tech jobs locally. So one of the ways that we decided to help support the foundation and support the activities of the nonprofit was to commercialize some of the advances that we've made, which we thought had value to help other researchers.
And give us an example.
Well, this is an example that really came from the embryonic stem cell field that I spoke about, and the induced pluripotent stem cell field. So those cells are very delicate, and they have to be fed with special media or broth that we put on the cells. They have to be fed with these nutrients.
So
every
broth,
single day.
The recipe for the broth becomes
you're
important.
Very So here's the deal, though. You have to feed them every day, 7 days a week, and every holiday you have to go in the lab and feed these cells.
Nobody gets off for Thanksgiving.
And no one gets off for Thanksgiving. And if you don't feed them, they start to differentiate and make things you don't want. So we said, you know, this is very expensive and it's very time consuming. Is there a way to do this better? And we looked at the medium, the broth, and we figured out that there was one component that disappeared very quickly. It had a half-life of 4 hours, and it was a key growth factor. So we thought, why not make a sustained formulation of that growth factor? So instead of having to feed them every day, you could maybe feed them every 2 or 3 days. So we did that. We found a molecule and a way of packaging it.
Did you patent that?
We did. So it's a method to feed growth factors to stem cells through a sustained release formulation. And now you have to feed those cells only once every 3 days. So now...
It's like feeding your fish.
It is. Yeah. It is. You know, and it's like feeding your fish when you're away. You have a little bit of food you can drop in there.
Slow release.
It's slow release, exactly. And so we get a lot of people. I presented the work at meetings, and then people would come up and say, you know, I'm going away for the weekend. Could you send us some? So we ended up starting a little spin-off company around this, which is also in Rensselaer. And we are now exporting this to, I think it's about 12 countries.
Is it expensive to buy that stuff?
Oh, no. It's very inexpensive. Very affordable.
Talk to me about
it. Yeah.
I mean, we have
a little bit.
I'm sorry, Sally. We have up here in Albany, in the region, we have nanotech. And there is nothing that nanotech can't have. They've spent, the state has spent millions, maybe billions by the time it's all over, on getting them here, robbing them from Austin, Texas, bringing them here. You've started this thing. Are you being treated as well as nanotech is being treated? Because it sounds like what you're doing is just as exciting.
Well, we would love to have some input, certainly, in to explore what we might do.
You may have to offer yourself. You may have to offer yourself to Austin to get even with New York.
So Texas could be an interesting place to try to do stem cell research, that we're doing. So we've had a lot of support from the Empire State Stem Cell Fund. And that was set up now a few years ago. It was to provide $600 million over 10 years. And this has been steadily dispersed. And we have competed successfully for some of that. So that's been very helpful. We would love to explore more the sort of biotech spin-offs around stem cells that we might do. And as you explain, I explain, some of that money then can come back to fund the basic research therapeutic initiative. And the reason that we structured it this way is that therapeutic development does take 10 years. Whereas for generating reagents, new reagents that can help people grow stem cells around.
Like the fish food.
Yeah. There's revenue that can come back very quickly. And so that revenue is like a little engine that can keep the therapeutic development going. So that's the idea.
It's just fascinating. Okay. So now you've explained basically the structure of the way this is going to happen. I mean, what do you dream about? I mean, at night, what are you dreaming about?
So I think the most exciting place to be right now is in this field of regenerative medicine. The possibilities of making a difference, a genuine difference in these diseases that currently have no cure. It's the most exciting thing, the most exciting place that you could be at. And I've only talked right now about using stem cells for transplantation. There's a whole other way that they're being used that could be beneficial.
For example?
You know, if you think about Alzheimer's disease,
sure.
For example, how do you find a drug that's beneficial for Alzheimer's disease?
Got to get rid of the plaque.
You know, exactly, plaques and tangles. You know, 10 years ago, all we could do was to take a mouse that we thought had a model of Alzheimer's disease and give that mouse some drugs and see how it, you know, did it help. Now, because we have human stem cells, we now have human neurons in the culture dish. So now we can model Alzheimer's disease with human cells, and we can put drugs on to see if it will impact human cells, not mouse cells.
Sally Temple, are you working on that?
Yes. So we are working.
So if you do that, they'll give you five.
Hard.
They'll give you five Nobel Prizes.
Wouldn't that be nice? Yeah. No, but it's another opportunity. So you can use these cells to make new cells to repair through a transplantation, or you can use the cells to create disease in a dish models and then use those to screen for new drugs or therapies. And this is a very exciting area. In fact, you know, we work with other researchers that are helping us build even three-dimensional models. We're working with Yubing Shi at the College of Nanoscale Science and Engineering, actually. Mm-hmm. And what she does is create new materials to grow stem cells in, and then you can create layers and structures and things that really mimic tissues. And then, you know, the other, it's not only more relevant to human disease, but you don't have to use animal models unnecessarily.
So how do we know, have you any reason to tell us today whether there's any reason to be hopeful, for example, about the Alzheimer's model?
Oh, I think that there is a lot of reason to be hopeful, absolutely. I think that the advantages of being able to have these cells in the culture dish accessible, you know, we have companies that have tens of thousands of compounds, some of which could be the next Alzheimer drug, but you don't know that until you've put them on the appropriate cells. And that's where we are at now. And people are devising these incredible high-throughput screens where you can put literally hundreds and thousands of wells on a little plate so that you can screen multiple compounds, different concentrations, and the output from these sorts of screens is just beginning now.
Well, this is astounding that you've given us this hour, I'll tell you right now, because you have to be a very busy woman. Do you do the research yourself? Do you hire others who do the research? You got started by doing the research yourself. Are you principally an administrator? How does that work?
So I'm very involved in the projects, in the design of the projects, although I'm not in the lab like I used to be, you know, pipetting media in. I am in the pipetting the broth into the, you know, into the cells to feed them. I'm not doing that.
I love the word. I've never heard it before.
Pipetting.
No,
it's good. But I look down the microscope at the cells. I review all the data, write the manuscripts. And so I am very involved in this, but I have an amazing team. Could not do it without a team of people. And each of them are working on different research and medical or biomedical projects. So they are focused, and my job is really to help make sure I facilitate anything that they need.
Is cash flow a problem?
It's always a problem. I mean, when you said, what do you dream about? Well, sometimes it's a nightmare. Sometimes I wake up in the middle of the night and say, how are we going to keep this going? Because, you know, this is our dream, to make this institute work. And I have 30 people who are on board with us. We have a fantastic board of directors who give all their time. And, you know, that's my responsibility, ultimately.
Do they also give you some money, your board of directors?
They help raise money.
So my goodness, it must be that somebody out there is listening right now and saying, you know, I have macular degeneracy, mm-hmm. and it's causing me to go blind. And, you know, I'm older now. I may be 80 or 90, and I have a lot of money. Why shouldn't I call Dr. Sally Temple up at the Neuro Stem Cell Institute and say, you know, God bless you. Here's some money. It would seem that it would be cheap no matter how much they gave you, wouldn't it?
Well, we would love that. And we would encourage whoever it was to come visit. Because I think if you come and see the community that we've developed and the dedicated people and hear what they're doing and look down the microscope and see the cells that we're working on, we would really like to have people involved. And so, you know, we welcome them, we welcome the visitors, we welcome the opportunity to communicate about what we're doing. A lot of people don't realize that there is a cutting-edge stem cell institute in their backyard.
You bet. I think that one of the reasons that this program is so important is that while I had intimations of it being here, nobody really knows enough about it.
Yes.
And this is a big issue. Do you have a director of communications who helps you with this?
Yeah, we just have a wonderful person helping us, Suzanne Koala, who has come on board and is beginning now to do that outreach so people will know more about us, we hope.
And you need a grants person, obviously, too. Right? Somebody who writes the grants?
We write the grants. Yeah. My husband and I, no, we have an empty nest now. Our youngest just went to University of Rochester. And since then, we've pretty much been writing grants. So no, there's nothing else to do now. So that's all. Other people do too, but we're the main grant writers.
Sally, tell us about that. You know, you're writing grants. It is a particular field. We know around here you get to know the program officer. If you get to know the program officer, who could be either encouraging or not, it's terribly important. So you've got to, in addition to doing this incredible hour with us, you've got to be out there all the time, right? I mean, you've got to be making those phone calls and talking to those people.
I should do more of that. To tell you the truth, there's only 24 hours in the day.
And we've got one of them.
We're biased. I'm biased towards doing the research. That's what I want to do. And that's where my passion lies. And so perhaps I'm not as good as I should be at doing those more political steps. For the national level, certainly, and for New York State, the way that it works is it's peer review. I mean, it is your peers who look at the work and say, does this have promise?
What if they're jealous? Excited? What if they're just jealous and they don't want to give it to you?
That's such a human thing, right? I mean, it's like democracy. It's the best we have. And so, peer review is the best we have right now. And we have to trust that people out there in this field are as passionate as we are and can put their individual sort of competitiveness aside. And, you know, we get much further if we can collaborate. And that's one of the beautiful things about the RPE stem cell project that we're doing, the retinal pigment epithelial stem cell project, because it was funded as a consortium. So we have five different groups involved, and learning from them and sharing, it has been tremendous.
Well, who becomes the lead?
Well, we initiated the project, and I would say we're the hub of the project, but the others play key roles. And
You know, in the end, every band ends up having a fight. You know, there's always a band fight at the end.
Yeah.
And then they bust up, the Beatles being the best of them. But, you know, my band did too. So when you enter into one of these collaborative relationships, you've got to be very careful. There's got to be all kinds of contractual material, things of that kind.
Yeah, yes, you do. And working through the paperwork there can be daunting because institutes can often be very reluctant to give away, as it were, any intellectual property. And this is actually a major thing that's holding the field back, in my opinion, because you have institutes that can sometimes overvalue what they have to the extent that they say no deal. So then they have 100% of nothing instead of, you know, a smaller percent of something real. And so we need to begin to sort of lubricate the process and get things going.
How would you do that? How would you lubricate?
I think we have to incentivize things differently. And, you know, just talking about a potential model, I think is really interesting that my husband, Jeff Stone, and I have been talking about, which is that there might be a way to de-risk this very risky process by having institutes be prepared to pool their IP, to put it into a pot. And then if that pot was then managed through the tech transfer process, matched up with the potential commercial partners, for example, you would then have a pot that could be valued more effectively than one single piece of intellectual property.
So it would sort of be like my TIA CREF, pie that they show you so much in this and so much in that. And so when somebody comes into the game, you say, okay, whatever comes in from the outside, you get a percent, right?
Right. And then it goes into the pot. It means that the pot can be valued more effectively. And, you know, when you think about it, this is what New York State does really well, right? It's sort of the securitization of these types of things. So wouldn't that be a really interesting way to deal with biomedical advances coming from New York State or other places?
Interesting. So there you are in Rensselaer, right? And wouldn't you be better off in New York City? He asked as a provocateur.
I don't think so. First of all, we love it up here. It's the most beautiful place to live. And it's been the greatest place to raise a family. But also, scientists don't earn a lot of money. We don't have the big salaries. So you can actually live in
Albany. Well, I don't know. The guy
Albany
over there at the tech place, it makes a lot of money. Makes more than the governor.
Oh, he makes more than... Well, most scientists, unfortunately, the people who work with me, we don't earn a big salary. So you can live in Albany on a scientist's income and have a great quality of life. We also, in this area, have Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, sure. Albany Medical College, the State University. We have really great higher institutes of learning and medicine that we can draw on.
Are they anxious, by the way, to participate?
We have had lots of relationships, especially collaborative relationships with scientists from all of those places, and really value that. And actually, the building that we are in is a building that is funded through the University at Albany Foundation. And it's a pretty unique building. It's a beautiful new building up on Route 9 and 20. And it was developed as a part of the campus where they could incubate sure. new entities, both nonprofit.
Perfect thing for you, incubation.
For-profit. That's what we need to do. Yeah, it's on all levels. Yeah. We have Regeneron right across the parking lot. And that's the number one biotech.
Is that right?
Last year.
And what's it like working with your husband full time?
Oh, it's wonderful.
There was just a piece in the Times.
It is about wonderful.
A piece in the Times saying this could be, you know, not the easiest thing in the world.
Are you talking, you're referring now to the band breakups, right? It's no, it, you know, people have said that to me. When, you know, now, okay, so anyway, you often marry someone and then you find out that when you're actually together,
yeah.
You don't see very much of each other because they're off in their job and you're off in your job. And so this has been just a wonderful experience.
So he's a physician.
Yeah, he started in basic research. He was at Rockefeller University doing biophysics of vision when I met him. Yeah. And then decided he wanted to work with people. So he went back to medical school to Miami.
A very fine medical school, it is.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And then he ended up matching in Albany to do ophthalmology.
And matching meaning that's where you take your
yes,
residency.
To do the residency here in Albany. And then a fellowship down at Mount Sinai in New York. And at that time, we said to ourselves, should we stay down or should we go back? Because we had loved our experience in Albany and we decided to come home.
So tell us a little bit more about the specifics of the science that you're dealing with. We've had a very nice little tour here of you. But first of all, one of the things that I'm impressed by is that you're a woman. And as you know, women in science is a huge hot topic, that there aren't enough women scientists. Mm-hmm. What do you think made you do this, that makes you different from all those kids who decide, I'd rather study Beowulf again?
It's a really important topic, actually, women in science. If you look in the training through postdoc, PhD level and postdoc, there are as many women, if not more women, in science. Where the attrition happens is when it goes to getting jobs. So moving into the faculty, then
why
it drops
off. Why is that? Are the faculty's pigs?
I think that we need to be proactive here. We need to hire women and we need to be very cognizant of that. And a couple of years ago, when I was setting the salaries for our institute and I wanted to make sure that we were in the right ballpark, I went to a website that was university professors and it did it nationwide, state by state, institute by institute. It broke down salaries and it broke down salaries for men and women as well. And I think it was almost every state and every institute, men were being paid more than women. And that was just a couple of years ago. So this has to be addressed. I am fortunate because I was able to have a family and also have a successful career. And that is partly because I chose Albany. Albany has a strong tradition of really promoting family, I think. And it makes it a great place to raise a family, and it makes it a great place to have a successful career as a woman.
So, in terms of your personal timeline, you've got the institute, you've got the foundation, you've got an offshoot, which is a profit-making institution, which you hope will help fund what you're doing. You know, what's next? I mean, you know, is it proceeding fast enough?
So when you mention all of those, each of those entities have a lot of support behind them. We also have a brilliant young researcher, Chris Fasano, who's working on autism and is also helping with the company. So I know it sounds a lot when you list it all out, but
it really is.
You know, we have help. There is one other thing that we're developing, and that is a for-profit company for the retinal therapeutics. And that is really part and parcel of what we're doing at the research center. So it will probably remain within the research center, but our intention is to be able to take the therapeutics for the retina that we're developing and then push it through that for-profit for commercialization, because we have to raise a great deal of money to make that a successful enterprise.
Now, Governor Cuomo, has called for using SUNYs to partner with developing companies, particularly upstate. Has that helped you at all?
So our door is open. You know, I am a professor also in the biomedical sciences at the university, and the University at Albany have been absolutely tremendous in supporting us in every step of the way. And so we
But it
certainly
seems to me
would,
it fits right into what he's talking about.
I know, it does. So I would like to learn more. But I'm not sure at this point if we're eligible, being an independent institute. But certainly, if the door is open, we would love to learn more and participate.
It's one of those things where, you know, you can get sort of screwed over by having been premature. In other words, being there before. Because if you walk in now and you say to the university, here we are, just what the governor wants, say, come right in. But if you're already there, it may actually be a penalty.
Yeah, I don't know enough about
You know what you need?
What?
You need a lobbyist. You need somebody who will go to the state legislature and say, you realize what you're sitting on here? You have, you know, the top thing in there getting awards. The principal researcher has one of the most prestigious awards below the Nobel Prize in the world. And then they go to bat for you. And then they say, the lobbyist goes and visits on state government and says, do a bill which supports them. So you need somebody who will do that for you.
You know, we do. Right now, our structure, as I said, our focus is on the research.
Sure.
And we're funded through grants for research.
Right.
So, you know, I know that these are things that we would like to embrace, but we have to primarily protect our position, which is a research entity, and that's where our funds flow right now. I know what you're saying is realistic.
Well, don't tell me that the Rockefeller Institute isn't getting money from the government or some of these other places aren't getting money. They are, and they have lobbyists, yeah. I'm sure.
You know, if we had the wherewithal, it's very wise advice. If we had the wherewithal, you know, we would do it.
Well, so, one of the things, not to prolong this, that I would do if I were you is look for some of the outstanding lobbying groups in Albany. And say to them, can you help us? Look, this can save your mother from having macular degeneration. You know, sometimes lobbying groups are very good about, because they represent some clients who not everybody thinks pass the stink test. But then when they get somebody like yourself who's doing all this wonderful work, it gives them a patina of decency. So maybe sometimes they do it. Something to think about.
It certainly is.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's great advice.
Okay. So let's review for a minute. We know now that stem cell research, which had political implications years ago, does not anymore, because now we find out you can take something right from the skin. I remember when I first read that and not have to do it, you know, from fetus or from umbilical cord or anything like that. Nevertheless, there still have to be people who object, religious people, for example, who say, you know, this isn't God's plan. That's a question.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting question. I actually had the opportunity to ask Richard Dorflinger that question, who was at that time, I think it was a meeting that was in Albany, and he represented a very strong anti-human embryonic stem cell lobby. And this was early days. And I had the opportunity to say, you know, we're at the point of being able to take fibroblasts and turn them into little induced pluripotent stem cells in a petri dish, you know, hundreds of thousands. Is this a problem? And he explained that from his point of view, that was not a problem, because his problem was in the destruction of an embryo and not in the artificial creation of this structure, but in the destruction of an embryo that had formed through the union of a sperm and egg. I thought that was very interesting. And, you know, we have talked in more detail with people here. We've had Bishop Hubbard come visit so that we've had the opportunity to talk and learn a little bit more about this.
Well, Bishop Hubbard is not exactly representative of the more conservative wing of the Catholic Church. That is for sure.
Yeah, so, you know, that may be. But I think that his willingness to come and learn about what we're doing, to my mind, was very impressive.
Oh, he's great.
Yeah, and what we were able to glean from this is that it does come down to that essential of destroying an embryo. What a lot of people don't realize is that the embryos that people use when they are making the human embryonic stem cell lines, those are what they call blastocyst stage. So they're smaller than a grain of sand, and they are being stored in vitro fertilization clinics. When parents go for IVF, often they will make, let's say, 30 embryos. They may only implant 12 or 6, and then there are a number left over that with time are not safe to implant anymore, but they're still safe to make human embryonic stem cell lines. So then the decision becomes, do I throw this away or do I make a line that could be valuable and health saving? And that decision, you know, you can talk, we've talked to lots of people with different religious views who are very persuaded by the argument that it is better to use that possibility of life than to simply throw it away.
Well, that's always the argument. We only have about 4 minutes left. I want to ask you something really quickly, and that is two words, big pharma. Now, obviously, you're developing stuff that in the end could save millions of lives. At some point, Big Brother, Big Pharma must be keeping an eye on you to see whether they want to come in and give you a lot of money to buy it.
Oh, you know, in some ways that would be good, certainly to license some of the things that we're developing. There's been a decimation of the research and development in Big Pharma over the past few years.
Why is that?
Because when drugs like Lipitor move into the generic realm, there was, you know, $13 billion.
But it was worth it up till then. Now you're doing something new. They get their hands on it, and they say until it does that, we'll make a lot of money.
So what I feel is that, you know, now they are also looking to the research institutes to basically develop the pipeline. And we would certainly be interested, but no one's contacted us yet. The door is open.
Well, I think you have to assume, Sally Temple, that they will. I mean, it sounds so promising, but that they will. Yeah. If somebody comes up with a macular degeneracy, is that the right word?
Macular degeneration.
Degeneration. You know, drug, they're going to want to have it rather than have somebody else have it, right? They have to compete with other people.
Yes.
It's all a question of how close you're getting.
Yeah, and there are companies out there that are developing products that certainly are competing with what we're developing. So it's a very active field. Actually, the retina and this particular disease, age-related macular degeneration, is being targeted by other companies as well, including Pfizer, for example.
Sure.
What we hope is that our potential therapy will offer benefit. I mean, there's not just one antibiotic. There's many, and there should be many cell therapies available. And as I said, we're also developing drugs through the disease modeling, the disease in a dish modeling. So, you know, when the time is right, certainly we would be very happy to partner because Big Pharma have the firepower to take these studies right through all the phases of the clinical trial, and they have the expertise to do that. And, you know, we would need to partner.
All I can say is this has been fascinating. If we can ever get another hour out of you, we would love to do it, Sally Temple, because this has been fascinating. We've been talking to Dr. Sally Temple, director of the Neural Stem Cell Institute in Rensselaer, New York. Sally, I can't tell you how pleased we are to have you with us and how much we all admire you for what you're doing. I'm Alan Chartard.
Well, thank you so much. It's been fascinating to speak with you.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.